out to Valdez Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez, Alaska. We're preparing to get underway with the second day of hearings by the subcommittee of the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee of the U.S. House, Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources. The committee met yesterday for some 6 hours, hearing testimony from the state, from the mayor of Valdez, and from fishermen. And finally, for 2 hours, there was a rigorous grilling of a number of officials from Alyeska Pipeline Company by a committee that was evidently prepared to take Alyeska to task. Today on the agenda, we have our first panel of the morning is Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins of the U.S. Coast Guard, who is the designated officer who is organizing and controlling Coast Guard efforts on behalf of Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Yost, and also Steve McCall, who is the commander of the Coast Guard detachment in Valdez, and through that position is also the port captain for Port Valdez. Later on this morning, we expect to hear a panel composed of representatives of Exxon, led by Bill Stevens, who is the president of Exxon USA. He'll be joined by Frank Iarossi, the president of Exxon Shipping Company, and they'll be assisted in their testimony and response to committee questions by Otto Harrison, who is the general manager of Valdez operations for Exxon Shipping Company. Otto Harrison, the man brought in, I believe, from Australia, Esso, to coordinate efforts in Valdez following the departure of Frank Iarossi back to Houston a few weeks ago. The committee is preparing to begin their deliberations this morning. The committee is composed, the subcommittee members are Representative George Miller, the chairman of California, Representative Wayne Owen of Utah, Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon. Yesterday we heard that Representative Bruce Vento of Minnesota was over in the Katmai area overflying the Alaska Peninsula coast to determine the extent of the spill. And they had hoped he would be here today. I don't see him on the podium now. We may hear word from Chairman Miller in a few minutes as to whether or not Representative Vento will join the committee today. Also with the committee is Representative Richard Durbin of Illinois, who is not a member of the House Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources Subcommittee, but is a member of the Appropriations Subcommittee of the House, specifically the subcommittee dealing with transportation, which of course includes the budget for the U.S. Coast Guard. The committee is doing the last few sound checks. This is almost reminiscent of the early days of the press conferences and such we heard. We've got a battery of television cameras and the lights and such, but of course this is not a press conference. There are no questions from the floor. There are no questions from the press members. This is a formal congressional committee hearing with a court reporter and taking notes, as well as a battery of recording equipment. The witnesses are sworn in, and that was quite a procedure yesterday. All the testimony given by witnesses is under oath, and that may or may not be a factor in the weeks to come as this testimony is corroborated with written submissions and the committee continues deliberations. Again, coming up today, Vice Admiral Robbins and Commander Steve McCall of the U.S. Coast Guard, and from Exxon,
the Subcommittee on Water and Power,
Chairman Miller is now calling the meeting to order.
We'll come to order for the purposes of continuing our hearings on the investigation of the Valdez oil spill, Prince William Sound. Our first panel this morning will be Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins of the U.S. Coast Guard and Captain Steve McCall, Captain of the Port of Valdez, U.S. Coast Guard. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. We're going to swear all of the witnesses in this hearing. Let me just ask if there's someone that you readily think you might be calling upon to help you, if we could just swear them at the same time. I'm not asking you to, if you think you're going to handle most of the testimony yourself or all of yourself, we'll just swear you, and then if you need some other resource, we can do that later. But is there anybody that comes to mind?
No, not right offhand. I may ask for some numbers or something like that if we get into the numbers. And
let me just say it's the practice of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it at investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
No, sir, I do not.
If you'd please stand.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
I do.
Thank you. In order to inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and of the committee are on the table in front of you, and both sets of rules have been previously provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel?
No, I do not.
No, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Admiral, welcome. And we look forward to your testimony. Your written statement will be placed in the record in its entirety, and you proceed in the manner in which you're most comfortable with this committee.
Thank you, sir. With your permission, then I will summarize and so that we can get right on to the questioning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased to meet with you and the other distinguished members of this subcommittee. Accompanying me today is Commander Steve McCall, Captain of the Port of Valdez, Alaska. As you know, the President directed the Commandant, Admiral Yost, to serve as the Federal Coordinating Director for the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup. And I am, of course, the Federal On-Scene Coordinator for the spill cleanup. Admiral Yost has spent several days up here, as have others, Secretary Skinner, and, of course, just lately, the Vice President. Admiral Yost has said that he is encouraged by the contribution of the many men and women from the other military services and the federal agencies who are working vigorously toward this cleanup effort. We all recognize that the task is enormous. This spill is one of the worst economic environmental calamities this nation has faced. Seeing the foul shoreline and beaches and devastating effect on life, wildlife, removes any doubt of the severity of this spill. I'd like to say that, for one thing, that we are getting excellent cooperation from all the agencies and parties involved in trying to minimize this spill's devastating effects. DOD has mobilized quickly. They have four major vessels and 25 aircraft and a variety of pollution response equipment, spare parts, and personnel. The Commandant has indicated that he is satisfied with the job Exxon has been doing, although he remains concerned with the optimistic timetable of their shoreline cleanup execution plan. The plan identifies over 300 miles that have to be cleaned up. We, in addition, are working hard to increase the federal effort, and we're working with Exxon to ensure that the necessary resources are brought to bear to accomplish the cleanup on schedule. Exxon, to date, has deployed approximately 70 miles of boom, 55 skimmers, 460 support vessels, and over 3,000 personnel. Nevertheless, it appears from the shoreline cleanup progress that they have to commit even more resources to meet the fall completion date. We are using cleanup equipment from Canada, France, the United Kingdom, and of course, you've, I'm sure, read a great deal about the Vitagubsky from the Soviet Union. The Coast Guard deploys about 7 major vessels, over 20 aircraft, and a variety of small equipment, and we have over 1,000 people involved in this cleanup effort at the moment. Much has been said about the adequacy of the contingency plan for the Port of Valdez. Likewise, the spill has raised concerns and doubts as to the adequacy of similar plans of all the U.S. major ports. The contingency plan for Prince William Sound was developed after enactment of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization Act in 1973. The state of Alaska required it as a condition of the facility's operating permit. Neither the original plan in 1980 nor the revised 1987 plan, and that's relating to the terminal operations, required approval of the federal government. The focus of the plan was threefold: notification, reconnaissance, and spill mitigation and control. clearly. The contingency plan was inadequate to deal with the enormity of the Exxon Valdez spill. The containment efforts were hampered by the rapidity with which the oil poured into the water, the remoteness of the location, and the fact that it occurred in the middle of the night. The circumstances of the Exxon Valdez grounding and the related maritime safety and oil spill cleanup issues are still under investigation. We are working with the administration in Congress to strengthen our laws, regulations, and operating procedures so that we can minimize the possibility of a spill of this magnitude ever happening again. I will be pleased to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much. Captain McCall, you do not have a statement, is that correct? Captain McCall, you were on duty the night of the accident. Is that correct?
I was at home.
You were home. You were notified by the duty officer.
By the duty vessel traffic watch standard, phoned me at approximately 12:30 in the morning.
And you then what? You did what?
He alerted me that the Exxon Valdez had run aground in the vicinity of Bly Reef. I immediately told him to notify my executive officer, and I got up, got dressed, got in the car, and drove into the office. Myself and the exec were in the office within 10 minutes, about 12:40. I walked into the traffic center, spoke with my watchstander, who assessed me of the situation as he knew it, and then got on the radio, Marine Radio, Channel 13, with the Exxon Valdez.
You talked to the captain and the master at that time?
Yes, sir. I spoke with the master at the time, Captain Hazelwood, who I have met previously. He introduced himself to me that he was the master, Captain Hazelwood. And he assessed the situation as he knew it to me, and I passed some, at the time, what I thought was obvious advice, but I felt that I had to pass it to him about to be sure of your situation concerning the grounding before you made any solid attempts to remove the vessel from the position that it was in.
That apparently was under consideration as far as he was concerned at that time, whether or not he could have rocked it off of the rocks or backed it off. Or...
Yes, sir. I felt that I was probably telling him the obvious because of his experience as a master in navigating, that a prudent mariner doesn't want to do anything too quickly once you're in a situation that you're not too sure of, as in this case being at least momentarily aground, if not permanently aground. And during those minutes when you're trying to determine whether or not you're hard aground or whether or not you just momentarily touched bottom, a lot of things are going through your head, and a lot of actions you're doing with your ship to assure yourself that you, as best as possible, are still in control of your vessel. And those are the thoughts that I expected to be going through Captain Hazelwood's mind. Didn't think I needed to elaborate on them, but felt that, to make me feel better, I felt that I should pass that word to him.
When did he first communicate to you that he was losing his cargo?
I believe that was passed to the watchstander at the time of the grounding, when he made the initial report at 12.
He knew at that time that he had ruptured.
I believe so, yes, sir.
His holding tanks. How was Alyeska informed?
Well, I know our office informed him by a landline telephone call. I would presume the ship had notified them also, but I can't confirm that.
Do they have that capability that we discussed yesterday with them, whether or not they have the capability to contact their...
Again, as was mentioned by Mr. Shire, I believe that they within range, atmospherics, whatever, may or may not have been able to contact the ship directly, or it could have contacted them through the Cordova Marine Operator, through a landline and marine operator techniques.
What was your responsibility? You now talked to the master. Alyeska had been informed. Your responsibilities are then what?
George, you need to approach that line.
Yeah, I think you got to bring the microphone.
Awesome. Much pleasure.
Several things are going through my mind. First off, is this better? Is this better?
Yep.
Several things were going through my mind at the time. Obviously, we knew there was a release of oil. There was a release of oil, so we knew that Alyeska had to initiate their response plan to get equipment out on scene. Also, I was concerned about the stability of the vessel and felt more comfortable having someone I was familiar with on a working basis on board the ship, namely my executive officer, who I directed with an investigating officer to get on board a pilot boat and go on out. They did, in addition to a Mr. Dan Lawn from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And they were directed to proceed to the ship and arrived about 0330 or so. So then that gave me a pair of eyes and someone I could speak to, not directly involved in the working or salvage of the ship, who could break away and talk to me and find out, in their opinion, what was happening. At the same time, I think it was about 12:55 in the morning that the phone call that I know I made was placed to Alyeska. I spoke to the Marine Superintendent on watch there. I think it was Mr. David Barnum, and it passed to him to pass to Larry Shire if he hadn't already known that the ship was aground, and that I forget my exact words, but I think there was something to the effect of we got to start thinking about maybe using dispersants or at least planning for them. And I think that was the last conversation I had directly with Alyeska for a while, because there were a lot of indirect conversations with people at Alyeska through people that I had directed to call on different matters.
You know, just to back up for a second,
mm-hmm.
you told to which individual did you say that they ought to start thinking about dispersants? To Shire?
No, Mr. Barnum, the Marine Superintendent for that. Don't have the last word correct, but the senior Marine person on watch over at Alyeska that evening.
And his response was?
I'll pass that along. Or words to that effect.
And then you did not have contact with Alyeska, direct contact?
Not for a while. I know Larry Shire stopped by our office on his way over to Alyeska to get an update, and I can't recall whether I spoke to him direct or someone else did and just told me that Larry stopped in. But in those next several hours between, say, 1 o'clock and 3:30, when Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein, my executive officer, was on board the ship, there were a lot of phone calls back and forth to my superiors in Juneau, to National Response Center in Washington, who was, you know, calling us after the word was initially passed. Representatives from Exxon, I believe, we were in contact with also. Mr. Harvey Borgen from Exxon, I had spoken with several times during the night.
Were you, did you have any discussions with people at Alyeska about what they were doing in response, whether or not they were assembling their equipment and manpower?
The process of the response and getting the equipment was presumed on my part to be underway, that they were calling in people and getting their equipment moving. From past experience, I know in spill response, things are always slower than one would like them to be, because it's just the nature of the beast, I guess. Things get slow, and you want equipment out there now, and you know it takes time. And I knew the response, the contingency plan allotted for approximately 5 hour response time. So I was satisfied in those early hours that equipment was being mobilized, equipment was going to be brought out to the scene. After my people arrived on board about 3:30 in the morning and were assessing the situation and realizing that there was a lot of oil being released from the ship at a fairly rapid rate, concern from my people on scene, in addition to the pollution response with the oil being released, also shifted towards an immediate salvage operation. They were very nervous about the condition of the ship. They were concerned about getting the rest of the product off or the rest of the cargo off before conditions shifted, if the wind came up or if the ship decided to move on the reef. So an added emphasis was put on getting, in addition to the pollution response equipment, I don't recall the exact time, but I know the word was passed to Alyeska. We also need the Yokohama fenders and the lightering equipment, the fenders that would go between one ship and another to keep the steel from rubbing and creating sparks and damaging either vessel.
Now, let me ask you, You told them that they were obviously loading tugs and I guess a barge with this equipment. You sent the message to Alyeska that you also needed fenders because you anticipated lightering. You were going to bring another ship alongside. And what else? What other equipment?
The lightering equipment, fenders, equipment necessary to moor one ship to another, which is a capability that they have. At the time, I didn't know that by making that request, we were basically, I understand now, taking away a crane from loading equipment onto a barge and having to divert it towards putting the fenders on the tug. I learned that later on. So I guess inadvertently, we slowed down their loading of the barge. But at the time...
Why was that again? Why?
Because apparently, as I understand now, the crane that was being used to put response equipment back on the response barge, had to be diverted to load fenders onto a tug.
So this is not a barge that can self-load. It doesn't have a self-contained crane.
No, sir.
How do they get the equipment off the barge when they're out there?
The booms themselves, once those containers are all placed on board, can be
So these containers, does this include skimmers? Were skimmers loaded onto this barge, or this just...
I don't know. I don't know the actual details of what they had to put on and what they specifically needed the crane for at the time. No. The only thing I knew later on was that apparently had slowed down the response. Well, at the time, I didn't realize that the barge itself was not in an immediate deployable condition.
You didn't know what?
I didn't know that the barge itself was not, in the process of getting tied up, hooked up to get underway.
You assumed that it was loaded?
I assumed that it was loaded sufficiently to get on out, yes, sir.
But everything was, we learned yesterday apparently that most of the equipment was stored in the warehouse and had to be moved to the barge.
Yes, sir.
So what time did they finally, so they sent the fenders out separately?
Yeah, the fenders went out on the tug. And I think they arrived approximately 11 o'clock in the morning.
Was that the tug that would be used to tow the barge to the scene?
There's separate tugs available.
Separate tug.
Which the choice of tug that they used was up to them.
And then what time did the barge arrive with, do you know what time, were you informed by the people on the ship, Valdez?
I believe the barge arrived approximately 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the pollution response barge with all the equipment.
Mm-hmm. So about 12 hours later from the time of the...
After the oil had ceased leaking from the ship.
These conversations that are carried on between the Valdez and your command center and people on the... on the Valdez, is there a record of those conversations?
The radio transmissions originating from our office on any of the frequencies that we use are recorded on tape, inch and a half recording tape, that we routinely save for 30 days, and unless something happens, we just re-record over those tapes. The tapes in this case, obviously,
used by the Transportation Safety
yes, sir.
Board people looking at.
In addition to that, I'd say about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, I had installed phone recording lines on our first three incoming lines for various reasons. As it turns out now, it was very good because we have at least the first three of our telephone lines, which the majority of the conversations involved in the initial hours are recorded on, because all incoming calls are on either one of these three lines. Some of the outgoing calls, my phone in particular, if I pick it up, it shifts to a private line automatically. That's not routinely recorded. In hindsight, maybe we should put more recorders.
Can the record of those calls be made available to the committee?
Yes, sir, they can.
Thank you. We'll make arrangements to do that. Mr. Durbin? Excuse me. Peter? Mr. Johnson?
Not from Mr.
Jones?
Representative Wayne Owen, Utah.
Let me review a couple of things that I think you went through with Chairman Miller. First of all, is there a checklist of what should be done in the event of a grounding, a ship running aground, instructions that you should give them?
Instructions that I should give the ship or that I should give my personnel?
Instructions you should give the ship, checklist of things not to do or to do. You said earlier that you told him, went over a list of things with him.
No, sir, we don't have, I don't have anything that's written down. That was just experience.
Does the Coast Guard have its own kind of contingency plan for this kind of a circumstance?
For the grounding or instructions to the ship what to do after a grounding?
For what to do in the event of a grounding?
Yes, sir, as far as notification, response, and investigation.
You may know that yesterday Mr. Shire and Mr. Polisak said that the reason that they did not move immediately to try to contain the spill with booming was because they were instructed by the Coast Guard not to do so. Could you respond to that?
Yes, sir. I was here and I made a note and consulted with my executive officer, who was the individual, Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein, the individual who I believe Larry Shire spoke with.
What's his name, please?
Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein.
Falkenstein?
Falkenstein.
And he was aboard the Valdez?
He was on board the Exxon Valdez.
When did he get there?
He got there about 03:30 in the morning with one of my investigating officers, Chief Warrant Officer Mark Delozier, D-E-L-O-Z-I-E-R, and then Dan Lawn from ADEC. The three of them were on board.
So it was he who spoke with Mr. Shire?
Yes, sir. And as he reiterated, as he explained to me, yes, we did not boom the ship because by the time the equipment arrived, the ship was no longer leaking, and the boom would be wouldn't be effective around both ships at that time.
Let me direct you to the content of those conversations first. What time did the first conversation take place? First of all, were these conversations electronically recorded as well?
No, these were from an Alyeska telephone line or phone patch to the ship. So they're not recorded on any of our lines.
They were not patched through your line?
No, conversations with Mr. Falkenstein and myself are recorded on most of those. I think all the conversations he and I had are recorded concerning.
All right, let me take you back to those conversations. The first conversation took place when and what was the content?
Okay, the first conversation between Mr. Shire and Mr. Falkenstein, I don't know the exact time frame on that. I think you have to take the whole picture into consideration from my.
We don't want the whole picture right now. We would like exact content of those conversations as best you can reconstruct them for us.
Okay, the exact time of the conversation between Mr. Shire and my executive officer, I don't know. In speaking with him, I understand it was probably in the 10 a.m. time frame, the time frame that we were concerned about having the fenders.
10 a.m., sir?
10 a.m. in the morning, yes, sir.
So Mr. Falkenstein was on the Valdez at 3:30.
Mm-hmm.
So for those 6.5 hours, there were no conversations between Mr. Falkenstein and Mr. Shire or anyone at Alyeska?
I don't know if there were other ones. There were a lot of phone calls between Mr. Falkenstein and myself that we passed information on to Alyeska. I know there were phone calls between Mr. Dan Lawn and Alyeska, and I believe Larry Shire. This is from discussions with Mr. Lawn. There wasn't a communications blackout between the ship and either our office, DEC, who was in contact, or Alyeska. The phone conversations, I believe, that you're interested in concerning the boom, no boom kind of thing, some were direct directly from Mr. Falkenstein to myself, as passed, as mentioned before, about getting the equipment out. In addition, we need fenders, we need the lightering equipment. And at the same time that those conversations were going on, leading up to this 10 o'clock or so time frame, we were looking at getting the Exxon Baton Rouge, another ship alongside, for lightering.
Yes, I understand.
The timing for the lightering aspect seemed to be around this 10 o'clock time frame.
Relate for me, though, that conversation, the 10 o'clock conversation, as best you understand it.
Okay.
And Mr. Falkenstein is not with you today, I guess.
No, he can be, you know, he's working, but he's not here right now. But we could get him, yes, sir. But at the time, I didn't think it was that critical, because as he expressed to me, by the time the equipment was arriving out there,
let me take you back to the conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
Relate the conversation, if you would, as best you can.
From he to me, from
your understanding of the conversation between Mr. Falkenstein.
Okay, the conversation went something to the effect that the boom, we don't need to boom the ship. We don't need to boom the ship. We need to boom the leading edge of the oil, because the ship has stopped leaking. So putting a boom around the ship, granted, could prevent further leakage or another release of oil, but the quantity of oil that was released had already gone away from the ship.
Yes.
I think it was strongly suggested yesterday that the Coast Guard chose the priority of lightering, and that that choice by the Coast Guard changed the dynamics of the response time of Alyeska. One of our concern is whether that is so or not. Two, the suggestion is that the lightering project somehow overcame any ability to boom or to now deal with the spill and the expansion of that spill, that one was inconsistent with the other. What you're telling us is by 10:30, early reports said that about 2 million gallons an hour were coming through the hole in the side of the ship, maybe more initially. By 10:30, there was enough oil for everybody, that somebody could go off and start dealing with the spill that was moving its way down the sound. And at the same time, the concern that Mr. Owens has, the ship could be boomed if that's what you wanted to do. Your suggestion was that the boom would be better, or your people said would be better deployed now dealing with the spill, because all of the oil, essentially, in terms of total spill, had essentially come out of those the hole. Is that it?
Yes, sir.
Is this a lie? Yes. There's two concepts here. When a ship is leaking oil, what you do is put a boom around it right away and try to contain it right next to the ship to keep it as close as possible. Once the oil has leaked from the ship, then you're chasing oil, and you got to get the boom out ahead of it. And that was the whole concept, as I see it, was to get that boom out to where it could start at the leading edge and try to get this oil stopped.
Well, between the 3:30 that your executive officer was on the ship and 10 o'clock, this first conversation, was there any conversations dealing with booming? Why didn't the booming take place earlier and in a broader spectrum to try to get ahead of the spreading oil?
The equipment, the boom wasn't there. The equipment hadn't arrived on scene until 2 o'clock or so.
But you had not instructed them not to bring the boom.
No, sir. No, sir. We had, you know, we were expecting the boom and the barge and equipment to be arriving. In addition, don't forget to bring, or we need you to bring, that lightering equipment, the fendering equipment, which we knew would be a timely arrival of that would be in that 10, 11 o'clock time frame, because that's when we anticipated having the Exxon Baton Rouge in a position to bring it alongside.
You did not instruct them not to bring boom.
No, sir.
Can boom be spread in the dark at areas beyond the ship?
Physically, it can, and I think with the amount of oil out there, it really didn't matter where you put it. It was, like you say, plenty of oil.
You're
going
to be catching something somewhere, anywhere.
Yes, sir.
But there was no booming done, and it was not done by your instruction. Is that what you're saying?
Correct, yes.
You're directly denying what was said yesterday.
Yes, sir. in the time frame that it was implied, and, you know, and by 2 o'clock, we were telling him, boom the oil, don't bother booming the ship. By the time the equipment arrived at 2 o'clock, the booming, the appropriate spot for the boom was at the leading edge of the oil or close there too, not around the ship, because the ship had not been, was not leaking anymore, and the, by not leaking, was not releasing a large quantity, it was still sheening off, but the large quantity of oil, the accumulated or the containable amount of oil was down channel.
I'd like to request, Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Falkenstein be requested to provide a record of his best recollection of those explicit conversations. Were you, do I have one time, one more question? Were you satisfied with the contingency plan? Maybe that should be directed. Admiral, you were not here prior to the spill, however.
That's correct.
I was not.
So, Commander McCall, were you satisfied previous to the accident with the contingency plan as it had been promulgated?
Well, officially, the Coast Guard doesn't have a chop on the contingency on that contingency plan for Prince William Sound. Our own contingency plan, based on the federal regulations, is obvious for the facility itself, the immediate vicinity of the oil transfer facility. That contingency plan we had reviewed and we had approved as part of the Alyeska's operations manual, federally required operations manual. Whether or not the equipment on scene was suitable for a spill away from the terminal, obviously, based on what happened, it's not. As a result of the Thompson Pass oil spill in January, the 1,700 barrels, which up to this point had been the largest, the equipment on scene responded satisfactorily to the release. But somewhere in between is a break point, and we've obviously exceeded it in this spill.
Thank you.
Chairman, I'd like to
move back.
Yeah.
We'll take another round.
I'd like to discuss the situations prevailing. We had a statement from Alyeska yesterday that said we contained the spill by directing it at the front with booms in zone one until the winds came up. Do you think that was a fairly accurate statement, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, the zone one, two, or three controversy or issue is a little complex. Normally, based on this dispersant use agreement, Valdez Arm is a zone one area where the OSC, in this case myself, when the oil was originally released, has the authority within some guidelines to authorize use of dispersants. However, March 1st, that zone designation shifted to a zone 2 in Valdez Arm. So when the ship initially grounded, it was in a zone 2 area. And the oil, because of the lack of wind and visual overflights that I made and videotaping of the progress of the oil, for the longest time remained in a zone 2 area. So it was not originally in zone one.
Okay, well then, the question is, did they have authority, at what point did they have authority to use dispersants on the spill?
When the OSC, in conjunction with the State of Alaska and the EPA, said they could.
Okay, and when did
Which was, they had submitted an application for dispersant use about 8:30 in the morning.
On Saturday?
On Friday. No, look, Friday. We're still on Friday. Friday night.
All right.
The 24th. The regional response team, Alaska regional response team, met about 9:45, 10 o'clock in the morning to discuss the issue of dispersants because it was in a zone 2 area. And I believe officially they were notified at 3:15 in the afternoon on Friday, or 3:10, that they could actually use dispersants.
Okay. So were they given just the authority to conduct small tests, or were they at that point authorized to use dispersants as they saw fit?
No, they were authorized to do a dispersant test by the RRT in conjunction with myself to determine whether or not the use of dispersants was appropriate. There's a lot of conditions that have to be met before the effectiveness of a dispersant is at its maximum. And looking at the video, looking at the situation, it was questionable whether or not the dispersants would be effective at all because of the sea state and lack of wind, thickness of the oil. The oil at that point in time was still pretty, the thickness on the water surface was still...
It was more than 0.01 of an inch.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Why don't we see the video then of the dispersant test, or why don't you explain to us what the video will...
The videotape is it's VHS home format, so it's not very professional. It's different segments. First segment is the Friday afternoon, March 24th, dispersant test using a helicopter spray bucket provided by the Cook Inlet Response Organization, CIRO. It basically shows the helicopter spraying. It's a little fuzzy. I didn't take this first. The first segment myself was provided to me by Alyeska. It's a little fuzzy, but you can see the helicopter spraying, and you can see the geographic area where it was sprayed, and you can see the leading edge of the oil. The next segment shows the dispersant test on Saturday, late afternoon, early evening, using a C-130 aircraft brought up by Exxon. The next segment is a dispersant trial on Sunday morning using a DC-6 aircraft. There was another dispersant trial Sunday afternoon done by Exxon. I was not on board, so I don't have video of that, but Exxon has that video, and that's the video that they talk about is appears to be effective. And then another segment later on that talks about after the wind came up on Monday afternoon, the attempted spray in the vicinity of Smith Island. And then there's another test later on where we sprayed outside Montague Straits, and then a final test outside in the Gulf of Alaska on April 14th or 15th, I believe. So there's five or six little pieces of information. I'm not sure how much you want to spend looking at other than the initial first day or two. Every dispersant test, with the exception of one, is on that tape. So I'm not sure if you want to
take us to, let's see if we go to Monday.
Okay.
I don't know how long that's going to take, but we'll...
How long does it take to run the whole thing?
The whole thing is probably about 15, 20 minutes.
Okay.
What you're looking at is the oil slick. There's a small boat in the area that was used, intended to be used as a sampling boat.
You're listening to a live coverage of a congressional subcommittee hearing in Valdez. At this point, the Coast Guard is showing a videotape to the congressional panel. Obviously, the videotape doesn't translate well for radio broadcast. The issue at hand is the question of the use of dispersants and the effectiveness of them. We will continue to bring you the interplay between the committee and the Coast Guard personnel discussing the videotape. At this point, the committee has been joined by Representative Bruce Vinto of Minnesota, who yesterday was out of speaking the Katmai and Alaska Peninsula area. This is the coverage of the Congressional U.S. House Subcommittee on Water Power and Offshore Energy Resources. The voice we'll be hearing is Commander Steve McCall, Port Captain of the Port of Valdez, U.S. Coast Guard, describing the scenes being shown to the committee on videotape, various dispersant tests, and the Prince William Sound oil spill in the first three or four days of the spill.
If you look at the water and the oil edge, it's pretty flat calm, very little surface energy, very little mixing action.
One of the significant areas of contention about the use of dispersants in the oil spill, which we've heard again and again throughout the press conferences, and quite a bit yesterday during...
The quality of photographs is the one I took next. Yes, but you can see it's very flat calm. Very little wave action at all. Now we're shifting to Saturday.
Again, the issue of dispersant boils down to when, who issued authority. Exxon claiming that dispersants could have been used had they been given the authority. The Coast Guard making a case today that conditions were not suitable for appropriate use of dispersant. DEC raising the issue yesterday that even if dispersant use had been approved, even if the conditions had been appropriate, there simply did not exist a quantity of dispersant or delivery method adequate. It will be quite a bit of the line of questioning, I expect, for the Coast Guard today. Again, Commander Steve McCall discussing the videotapes.
Gallons of dispersant did they put on the oil in that first test?
About 50.
50 gallons?
Yes, sir.
Congressman George Miller, the voice you hear asking the question.
Test, how much dispersant falls on the in the literature they talk about, some of the dispersant just stays in the air, stays suspended.
Well, the rate, the application rate they're talking about was that 1 to 20. One part dispersant to 20 parts oil.
Did you limit that first test to the 50 gallons, that was just what they had capacity to do?
I'm sorry. It was conducted. Lighting was dropping off. There was no surface action, so the decision was made by all parties involved that Exxon has a C-130 coming up tomorrow. We're used to C-130.
Okay,
tomorrow.
So on the first day, all that was available was the helicopter in the bucket. Okay.
Yes, sir.
So everybody sort of agreed to wait
until C-130.
Yes, sir.
Again, you're listening.
Shows a lot of the background mountains from my own orientation, so I could keep track later on as to what I was looking at. But you can see the leading edge of the oil is still pretty well defined, and you'll see it. There's a C-130. If you ever used to flying on a C-130 aircraft, it's an interesting sight watching it fly 50 feet off the surface of the water, getting ready to spray dispersant. Still pretty well defined, and we'll see it. There's a C-130. If you ever used to flying on a C-130 aircraft, it's an interesting sight watching it fly 50 feet off the surface of the water, getting ready to spray dispersant.